Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 57 of Season 7 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is my good buddy Alan Sanders of the, see if you can guess it, the Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Hey, happy Tuesday, buddy.
Happy Tuesday to you and everyone out there. Nice that everyone's willing to come back and listen again. You know, even after having listened to yesterday's show. So
I'm hoping they're back. I hope you haven't lost your audience.
Well, come on. As we mentioned yesterday, you've been on every season so far. So if, you know, if people have problems with Alan Sanders, they will just skip your episodes. You know, if they're still here, so that's already a good sign.
Good. Well, it is a pleasure, as always, to be back.
Yes. So, Minute 57 begins with the repairman giving a quick response and ends with Katya opening and approaching a door. So, we ended things yesterday with some very interesting things that they started showing us here. You know, Simon and his men are starting to go down the elevator, and then we see some of the guards that are noticing that something is going on here. And, you know, one of them calls over his supervisor, and as he's walking over, he passes by some repairmen and basically says to them, "Oh, yeah, you know, I hope you're going to be done soon." And the way that yesterday's minute ended was with the repairman about to give his response, and today we get the response where he goes, "Just a minute now." You know, so he gives a nice quick response to the whole thing as he walks by. And then they do a great editing job here, because as this supervisor is walking towards the door, we see like the elevator door open at the same time, you know, meaning that it's a completely different shot, but it could theoretically confuse someone to think that they're looking at the exact same door opening or whatever it is. And we see Simon come out of the elevator walking towards a door, and then he takes off his button-down shirt, and we get to see that Jeremy Irons pumped some iron in order to take this role. You know, he has his sleeveless shirt on, you know, to show off his muscles and stuff like that, with all of his men behind him with their guns, and he's got his guns.
So here's something you were talking about, the editing, and I wanted to mention this as well. I think they must have set the camera up on a very similar tracking shot from both of these kind of like the interposed scenes, because it starts low and it kind of, as the guard is walking by the camera and going to the door, the camera swings behind him. So you get this motion of the camera swinging to the left as he's crossing kind of to the right. So you kind of got this X cross. That's exactly the same motion and speed when we cut to the elevator, and it does the same thing. And I think that's why it cuts together so nicely. What's also amazing, I always watch for little continuity errors, and either they had two cameras going or Jeremy Irons was masterful at taking his shirt off exactly the same way as he was walking through the one camera shot heading into the next room, because it's exactly where it was as he's taking it off when the camera cuts to the other room.
Yeah.
It's so continuous and so precise. It's like they had multiple cameras going. If they didn't, the fact that it matched it's just amazing. I'm watching just the direction and the camera movements, and it's so engrossing. And you may not notice those kind of things as a first time movie watcher, but just the filming technique here is phenomenal.
Correct. No, I completely agree with you on it. Do you think that it is a separate, like a separate camera shot, or is it, you know, do you think it was a continuous shot, you know, between him going from room to room or not? What do you think?
I don't know. It matches so precisely because he's got the shirt exactly in the same spot. It's his right arm. It's coming behind him. But I don't know where you would have put a second camera. I mean, I guess you could have, and the two cameras just don't get in each other's eye line, but it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because it is a different angle. The camera's in a completely different position. So it's either a second camera or a second shot.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to believe that it's a second camera because of the way that he's taking his shirt off. You know, I mean, don't they do that with like sitcoms that you know, you might have multi cameras, so someone walks from one room into the other, and therefore you're just getting it with him. I don't
Yes,
know.
generally you'll have two. Generally, on a sitcom or a fixed stage, you'll have two or maybe three. So that way, someone in the controller, kind of like your newscast at night, when somebody's walking over to the sports screen or walking over to the weather screen or back to the desk, you've got multiple cameras. So that way, they can just cut. Well, go to this camera, now go to this camera. It's just usually in Hollywood, you normally, because of the expense of the rigs, unless you're doing a really big kind of a master shot and you've got a bunch of stuff going on, like a big, huge fight or something, generally you wouldn't have two cameras, but it's possible.
I don't know. I'm looking at it. I'm scrubbing back and forth between second two and second three, and it looks like a
I
very
know.
fluid motion here of him taking that shirt off.
I
So
know. But it could be that Jeremy Irons is just that much of a perfectionist that he did it exactly the same each take.
yeah, but
It's
to say, okay, I'm gonna start shooting where my shirt is at this part of my forearm and stuff like that. I mean, that's a real perfectionist.
I know. I know it's, but you know, if they had the other camera set back in the room and they said, okay, go back and he had a T marker that says, okay, this is where I start taking my shirt off, and he does it the exact same way, it could very well be that we got lucky and they matched. No matter what, these cuts, these edits are seamless, and I haven't found a continuity error at this beginning part just yet. It's great.
Yeah.
And I love it because we're going to cut right back, you know, to the security guard. I mean, it's bang, 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 but it's not. You know, there are a lot of movies that do cuts just to make it feel like it's frenetic. They do a lot of real like hyper cuts, and so you're constantly bing, 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 bing. And then sometimes it feels disjointed. This doesn't feel like that at all. It feels kinetic, but it feels smooth.
Yeah. Interesting. So the editor of this movie is a man named John Wright, who passed away a little more than a year ago. He passed away on April 20th, 2023. But looking at some of the movies that he edited, unbelievable. I mean, he has 43 edited movies in his career, but included in them, besides this movie, is The Running Man, Speed, The Hunt for Red October, Secretariat. I don't know if you've seen that. I love that movie. He did X-Men. He's basically, he's pretty much done all of a lot of McTiernan stuff, because I see that he also did the Thomas Crown Affair, and he did the 13th Warrior, which you and I mentioned, I think maybe after the show ended yesterday, but I don't remember if we talked about how bad that movie was. But
Did not. It was one of the few movies I couldn't, and it was only because it was on late. It was on cable, and I was flipping around. And I couldn't watch it. It just became unwatchable to
yeah,
me.
he also did The Last Action Hero. There you go. So you see, McTiernan used them a lot. Let's put it that way. Not in every one of his movies, but he used them in a lot of them.
It seems like, and when you mentioned X-Men and some others, he's got a handle for how to move, how to hit those cuts in those kind of action, but yet the story-based action movies. It seems like all those movies you mentioned are not just shoot 'em up, kind of like, you know, well, Speed even technically is a little bit of there's a thinking part of that movie. So
Well, and think
I
about the
like
type of
it gives
editing
you.
one needs to do speed. I mean, that was just, constantly moving with, the whole time. And he was nominated twice for an Oscar for Speed and for The Hunt for Red October. Those were the two movies that he was nominated for.
Fantastic. Both phenomenal. I mean, there is a skill to action movie direction to make it not feel like you're getting lost, but yet keeping that sense of that kinetic energy constantly keeping you on the edge of your seat. So I love the editing of this. I still think, as we mentioned yesterday, I still think Die Hard 1 is the better overall movie, but this one's my second favorite in the trilogy. It's very, very well done.
I definitely agree with you that it's great. I mean, I have trouble basically putting the top three, the three movies in order, because I love all three of them so much. So, and
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. If I'm ranking them, it's not because the third one sucks. It's only because one edges out the other, but
right.
they're all phenomenal. This is one of my all-time favorite trilogies.
And we'll maybe get to that today when we talk about trilogies at the in today's segment. Well, who knows? We'll have to wait and see how that happens. So basically, Simon walks over towards this door, and as he's hit, stands next to the door, as you mentioned, the fluidity here is just amazing. We see the security guard on the other side of the door, pulling the door open, not knowing that Simon is on the other side. But we've, the way that this is shot and edited, we know that Simon's on the other side of that door, even though he doesn't. Which is great. They do it really well. Did you notice what's on the door as the security guard is pulling it open?
Yeah, a
That's
dartboard.
correct. So what do you know about dartboards?
Oh, about dartboards? I know about darts. I've played darts before,
Okay.
but I don't know about the board.
Okay, darts also has that. Either is fine. Which you know about darts?
Well, yeah, I've played darts. A lot of pubs I've played darts. We actually had a dartboard when the kids were little. We would play darts downstairs in our sort of office slash game area. So, I mean, I just something I've always played.
Okay, it is, as you said, a traditional pub game, and it's also a shooting sport. It's commonly played in the UK and in Ireland, and recreationally, it's enjoyed around the world. Meaning that, I guess it's more of a competition in the UK and Ireland. Do you know approximately when the game was invented? I mean, again, it's based on archery and stuff like that. So archery goes back much longer, much further back. But I'm saying the game of darts itself.
Is it? I have no idea how old it is.
Okay, so it was a.
My best guess is sometime, I would guess somewhere in the 18th century, maybe
Okay.
1700s.
1860 was when.
18.
1860, yeah. And in 1908, it was declared a game of skill, and therefore they allowed it to be used in pubs. There was, yeah,
Okay.
because there was a court case where someone allowed the game of darts to be played in a pub, and people considered it a game of chance, and games of chance were not
Oh, you.
allowed on in in pubs at the time.
So, like, you couldn't gamble, you couldn't have
That's right.
cards, but you could play this. I gotcha.
That's right.
Interesting.
That's right. And what they ended up doing was is that the owner the basically the owner of the pub brought in one of the best dart players in the area, a guy named William Bigfoot Anakin, and they hung a dartboard in the courtroom, and he proved that dart was not a game of chance. Because he hit three double 20s in a row, for the court,
All
showing
right.
them that, this is a skill. It's not a game of chance. So
Well, with the name Anakin, how do we know he didn't use the
he
Force?
might have, but my assumption is back in 19, was it 1908, people were not thinking about people were unfamiliar with the idea of the force.
I gotcha.
He could have used the force, but they
But.
wouldn't have known. That's what he was using. Nowadays we know that, okay, if someone does something like that because they're using the force.
William Bigfoot Anakin, what a name. William Bigfoot
That's
Anakin
right. Well, they kept the Skywalker part hidden. Now what were
Well, they did say that it all happened a long time
that's right
ago.
in a in a in a pub far, far away.
Far, far away.
Exactly. What do you think dartboards were traditionally made of before World War I? It's changed, but before World War I, what did they?
Right. Well, I've always thought they were cork, that they start off as cork. So that's what I
Well,
would guess,
they
a
start off
cork
as
board.
wood, usually elm.
Okay.
But the problem was is that the darts caused so many holes in it that the 20 in the middle, it was harder to hit because the hole there was a deeper hole each time. because of the way people were hitting it. And so what they ended up doing was they ended up switching it, and they tried many different things. And then they, in 1935, the two guys came up with the idea of using what's known as a century plant to make dartboards. And they would take all these fibers and bundle them together. And when they were compressed into a disc and bound with a metal ring, so then they were able to then, you know, throw the darts in it, and you didn't have to maintain the dartboard that much. And it did little or no damage to the board, because it was every time you threw it, it was parting the packed fibers inside instead of creating holes and stuff like that. I think like one of my brothers had a dartboard, and there was like tons of holes in his wall because of that. You know, I think my parents weren't too happy about that, obviously. So yeah, I love seeing little things like this. So apparently the security guards in the Fed, you know, are pretty bored most of the time when people are not trying to rob them, and they're sitting there playing darts. You know what? For me, it's interesting though that you don't see the darts stuck in the board itself, because it's usually the best place to keep them.
Well,
isn't it?
You're not supposed to leave them in the dartboard,
because
whenever we played, I always thought you were not supposed to. So that way those fibers would kind of heal over time rather than keeping a wedge in the board.
Okay. But, maybe. You know, I don't know. I'm not familiar enough to be able to tell you.
We also had, you know, we didn't have like the kind that usually come with a cheap board. We actually have nicer darts that came in their own case. So we just put the darts back in the case.
Okay. Sounds fair. So the guard goes to open the door, and he's not looking outside the door. And as he opens the door, he quickly sees Simon and a few of the guys with him, Carl and someone else, holding guns on him. And he ducks down and closes the door. Now, I love the shot, because this guard doesn't know that he's already been trapped. You know, it's right. Not as if their goal on the outside is, okay, someone's going to open the door, we're going to shoot them. You know, but it also makes me wonder, what was Simon's original plan? Like, he didn't know that this guy was going to go open the door.
No.
You think he was going to knock?
And I think, no. So without giving away the rest of this week, I think the plan was to make his way kind of like video game wise to each stage, waiting for the people that might be inside of the next door to open the door, let him know it's clear. He knew he had two people in there. We didn't That's know right. it, but he knew he had two people in there. So I think he was going to wait at the door until they opened it for him.
Right.
The fact that it was this guy opening the door, just it was by happenstance. But I think he stood there because he wasn't going to walk in until he knew the room was
secure. So if that's the case, why is Carl standing there with a gun pointed if they think that it's going to be their guys that are opening the door?
Well, you don't know if somebody's going to try to escape the room as well.
Okay. But it goes back to our question from yesterday, you know, is their plan to kill everyone or just to inoculate them? You know, that type of thing.
I think their plan is to kill as few as necessary, but they have no problem if they had to kill everybody.
Okay. That's fair.
It feels like, and I know, again, we're only looking at this minute, but it feels like if you're not resisting or you're cooperating, your chance of success or being left alive are pretty good. If you're doing something to endanger them or in any way maybe are a threat, then I think they're going to eliminate the threat.
That's fair. So as he's opening the door, the guard says, okay, I'll be right back. And then he quickly screams, down! And he...
By the way, this goes to my comment yesterday. I love the fact that we don't have an incompetent guard. Sure. He reacts as if he's been trained. He knew instantly there was a threat and didn't just sit there looking stupid. He reacted and didn't have any idea that he was, you know, going to have the two guys behind him. I just think
And awesome. he draws his gun in very fluidly as he's, you know, pushing against the door, and he ducks down at the same time. Also, he doesn't stay at the same level. So I think that's great. Also.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, you know, he looks up and he sees that the two repairmen basically pull out guns. One pulls out like I think it's a MAC-10, and another one pulls out just it's also probably a MAC-10. And
they both look like
machine pistols, And he just shakes his head. He doesn't even have to say anything. He's like, don't even do it. It's not even worth it.
Yeah.
You know,
And it's a playful almost smile because he's got his head cocked to one side and he shakes like it's a half no. It's like a
That's right.
You know, he doesn't even have to do a whole. You just don't do it.
That's right.
And then the dude behind him was like laying on the couch. He's like, uh-oh.
Exactly. But wasn't there a third guy in the room also? Oh, no, the other guy was outside of the room, the one from yesterday. Mm-hmm. See, that's what it was. He was outside the room, so he called him in. So he was on it. This guard was on his way towards the other guard. Maybe that's what it was.
Right, because he had the video.
Correct. Screens. Correct.
So we'll be
going. We'll get to him. Yeah.
I can only say this because I know the movie. We'll be going to the video screens at some point this week.
Yes, we shall. We shall. And then we see Simon and his men, move to the next stage, as you said, moving up to the next, what's it called, boss, in the video game. You've taken over this one, and you're moving to the next one, and they start moving forward, trying to. They do it in a very nice military style. They use hand signals and everyone, even though they're not dressed as soldiers, act like soldiers, with the way that they're moving across here.
Yeah, militaristic, I think, is the right way. They every motion is for maximum efficiency. They're not doing a lot of crazy movements.
Correct. Right. And then we see that there's a mirror that's in a corner, which I think is a great thing to have there, so that anyone walking from either side can see what's going on there, around the corner. And that mirror gets shot, and we're not 100% sure who it's shot by. We can pretty much put the pieces together and figure out that it's the guard who actually shoots it, because we hear the scream, "Stay back, stay back." And it's done really well. And Simon is very calm throughout this whole sequence. He's just very calm about the whole thing. He then puts his fist up, and that's a known thing in movies that, someone in a military situation puts their fist up, that means stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you notice, before the mirror gets blown out, the guy in the brown shirt ahead of Simon, who's kind of peeking around the corner, is the first one to put his arm up.
Correct.
So he's putting his arm up. You hear the shot. Simon is at the same time, like it's simultaneous. The guy the choreography is great. The first lead guy puts his arm up. Simon, as he's putting his arm up, the glass gets shot.
Yeah.
Which to me indicates, because I was going to ask, well, why is the guard shooting? They haven't heard a sound yet. We don't know. But obviously he saw the guy peeking around the corner.
That's right. And they also, I'm sure that they planned this well enough to know that there's a guard station over there.
No, but I was talking about, why was the guard just randomly shooting? He calls, hey, come over here, take a look at this. Something's going on. He hears a door open. He doesn't know it's a bad guy coming his way. He's just going to probably assume, why would he shoot? And it had to be when you stage the guy who puts his arm up first, the guy in the brown shirt kind of looking around the corner, it adds that level of like, oh, he must have seen this guy peeking around the corner, and he saw in the mirror, here comes more guys, so he shoots out the mirror, so that way he himself isn't being given away.
Exactly.
Because obviously as a mirror, other people could see where he was. So it's a lot of thinking into a very short, 2 seconds two seconds.
100%. Wait, which is why I love doing this minute by minute, because because when you watch this movie, you don't pay attention to these little things. I don't think I've ever noticed that mirror shot, until now, because it's inconsequential. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make a difference when you're watching the movie. But when you're watching it like we are.
Yeah. Well, it goes to show that every action, or at least so far, all the actions of the actors are in the story are motivated by something real, other than we just need you shooting, or we just need you, jumping for no reason. Like everything seems motivated, which adds to the realism. And again, you start feeling engaged and connected with the story more.
100%. And then we see like a far shot of this guard, who's shooting with a pistol. Trying to keep them away, keep them back. He shoots a few more bullets, And then it's very funny what he does. He puts the gun down on the desk and then picks up keys in order to open up the, a cabinet of with shotguns. It's got like two shotguns. Which I always find funny that if someone who's guarding something like this, what is the added value to have something like that locked up where you need those extra few seconds in order to go open it? And we're going to find out in a few seconds that how, or maybe it's even tomorrow, that it's even less convenient with what they've done there. And
Right. And I don't know that it's a flaw of the movie, but it is an interesting level of quote government bureaucracy.
correct.
Was there some rule about, well, we can't have armed weapons lying around, we can't leave weapons
Correct.
loaded, which we're gonna you can deal with government bureaucracy, but I don't think it breaks the reality of
That's
the
right.
scene. I think it questions the readiness of these
Correct.
guards.
Which in ways these guys are ready, just not 100%. There's something deterring them, and that's not necessarily them. That's the whole thing. So then, and then the, as he puts the key in to open up this little cabinet, so the screen pans to the left, and we see three monitors behind him. And on the monitors, there are two, I don't even wonder what you would call them, two folders, and one of them you can read, it says lockbox number 44. The other one, I think it says 48, but it's a little blurry. So I'm not really sure what exactly, what they're trying to tell us, what are they writing here in this lockbox? I don't really know. But if you look at the monitors, so the monitor on the left shows like a gate with now we know that what's behind the gate is a whole bunch of bricks of gold, right? And we start to see like sparks flying from there, and they do a great job of zooming in, and as they're zooming into the screen, it like switches, and we actually get to see the real place that this is happening. Again, goes back to the
Yeah,
editing of what we were talking about before.
this is the exact opposite of yesterday when they would start showing us on the monitor and then pull us back into reality. Now we went to the monitor and then into
Correct.
reality.
Yeah, it's very, very cool the way that they do it. And you can see the I don't know what it what I don't even know what you call these things. I've been trying for weeks to look it up what you call these boring
That's exactly
It's
I was
not
going to say
boring,
a
but
boring
it's
no, not I'm bored, but I'm going to
a
bore a
boring,
hole
that's right,
into
a
the
boring
earth.
drill or something like that.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
boring machine. It's got to be. That's what I would. I mean, that's certainly the kind of what you would use if you were working on building tunnels or aquifers or something that
Right.
obviously is going on not
That's
far
correct.
away.
And then we get a shot of Katya on top of some sort of maybe it's the boring machine, and then she comes off it, and there's a guy welding on the side, and we see him from a number of different.
I don't think he's welding. I think he's using a saw.
Is he using a saw there?
Yeah, I
Okay,
think it's a
right,
little
sorry.
portable or it's a compressor to cut the
Right, okay,
bars.
that's right. That's right. He's got a disc. Right, there's a disc there that he's cutting through the bars, and we see all the sparks flying and stuff like that, which again is great. And then the next shot we see, we're back onto the monitor, and we see Katya already having gone through the those bars that guy was just cutting through. And you can actually see that he's giving her a hand, helping her down. She doesn't just go through on her own, which is also great. Through the monitor, you can see that the guy who's using the disc has helped. He stopped. He stopped his job and basically is helping her by giving her a hand to get through, which is also. You think when you think of this character in the movie, you think of this vicious woman, who doesn't want help from anybody or whatever it is. But she's willing to get this help in order to get through. So I like the way that they show that also, the whole thing.
What's interesting is they must have climbed on top of the gold And you kind of just, and you see it only when she's hopping over. It's not the machine that she's crawling over. They're literally, he's already, and this is so compressed in time. They don't have to show that somebody gets off the vehicle. We saw that the borer has already broken through the back wall. When we see her climbing, she's literally climbing over the gold because he's actually cutting down the gate that would have been to get access to the gold from the inside.
Right. Well, no, because they've bored into one of the cells that has the gold, but the idea is they want to get into all of them, you know.
Right. What I'm saying is it almost looks like you think she's climbing off the machine. She's not climbing off the machine. She's actually on top of the gold when we see her climbing.
Correct.
And so, and I love it because you're trying to still figure out, well, what's going on? I love it that even though we're in the midst of the heist, we're still compelled to keep watching. And I love how cat-like she is. She is sort of like the Pepe Le Pew. She's not interested in going fast. She doesn't have a sense of urgency. She's actually a perfect foil to Simon, who you said is also cool as a cucumber. So is she. She is totally cool. She's not in any rush, no panic
Which,
at all.
Which says, you know, it could be somewhat of a hint towards the future of this in this movie because we know that Targo is constantly, he's rushing. He's not someone who is taking his time like she and Simon are. And then she walked towards the monitor, you know, like you said, in the cat-like manner. And then they once again pan back to this guard, and he's still inserting shotgun rounds into the shotgun itself. And
well, what I like is when we last left him, he was trying to open the case with the shotgun. We don't have to see him remove the case. We don't even need to see it. We know in our heads because we cut to the other room for a few seconds that obviously he has gotten the gun out and is loading it. So again, economy of the of movement. It's economy of shots. It just keeps flowing, and we in our heads already have filled in. Okay, he's gotten the case open. He got a shotgun out. He's loading it. He's still holding, or for whatever reason, they're choosing, which I think is the same thing with the other room. Simon and company knows, okay, there's a guy at the end of the hallway. We're not going to put any of us at risk. We're not going to do anything unnecessary because we know there's somebody behind that guy in the next room. We'll wait for her or whomever they're waiting for, but obviously it's going to be her to clear the room.
And then he picks up the phone and dials what looks like 7 and 5, but I'm not 100% sure. And we hear him say, come on.
It's double five. He does double fives, which I don't know why extension 55 is... You know, who's he calling at extension 55?
Ah, okay, I see. Because he has a second finger that looks like it's on top of the 7, but you're right. Okay, yeah. So he does 55. Okay.
Yep. Because he's using his middle finger to double press, and I think his ring finger just is hovering. But it's really weird because normally if you have to get an outside line, you normally click.
Well, no, he doesn't have to get, he doesn't want an outside line. He wants to probably call the front desk or something like that. He's not calling 911.
Right. And well, why wouldn't he?
Maybe he thinks that there are still people upstairs that can come down and help.
Maybe. And that's fine because in terms of the movie, most people aren't slowing it down long enough to see why he. And all I can think of, well, you're just dialing an extension. But normally, if you're going to dial an inner office extension, you'd have to click an extension button or something to let it know you're not trying to dial out. Since it's a normal keypad, but he just dials 55. Yeah.
So he waits for an answer anxiously and goes, come on. Oh, and, you know, we can see the panic on his face as he's doing this. Mm-hmm. And then they give us another shot of Katya continuing her cat-like walk, you know, within the entire vault area. And as she's walking, she takes off. One glove, then she takes off the other glove. I mean, it looks like she's doing it in a very sensual way.
Right. It's almost a striptease.
That's right. Like, this is what she loves. You know, this is what turns her on, I guess you can say. You know,
what's great though, is we get just enough of her face. There's not, which I'm glad, there's not a smile. She's not, like, thrilled in the sense like she's getting off on it. She's serious on her face. She knows she's got a job, but she's not rushing.
And then they give us another shot of the monitors, and we see the middle monitor, and she stands near a big wheel that is getting ready to open the door.
Certainly looks that way.
And that's how this minute ends. Yeah, a lot to talk about here. There was a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I have to say the camera moves, because even when Simon and them get in the hallway, the camera sort of does that same sort of from the right to the left swing. It's not really big, but because the camera's also turning on its swivel head on top of either the tripod or the mount that it's on. So you've had this in multiple shots where it's swinging in and turning to the right as the actors are crossing in front of it. So it adds that sort of motion, but it also adds a little bit of extra energy, because as the camera's moving to the left, the subject's kind of moving to the right. And it just, once again, this kinetic energy, you feel like we're tightly winding a spring. And at some point it's just going to, you know, bing. And it keeps us, I think, as movie watchers, it not only keeps us engaged, but we feel that energy as well, which keeps us glued to what's happening on the screen.
Right. Yeah, they do a great way of doing it. That's all I have for this minute. You have anything else you want to talk about for this minute?
No, just I'm glad you had in your notes about the edit and it got us talking about that. And I know sometimes I get more focused sometimes on the filmmaking aspect, but I love when you pay attention to what a good filmmaker, like what's the difference between, why do these shots feel so much better than, let's say, if the camera just stayed static and you had the exact same setup? You can look at like two movies and say, well, why is this one so much more engaging? And sometimes it's those little things that you're not even maybe aware of technique wise, but because it is part of the filmmaking process, it's the difference between maybe something that feels flat and dull versus something that feels alive and vibrant.
Right, exactly.
And I love
that. Yeah, and it's great. Because also they want us to feel the tension, and they do a great job mm-hmm. of doing that. All right, so the script. So as I keep saying, over the last few days, the script keeps jumping back and forth, but the part that talks about what this particular scene. So you have the downstairs corridor outside the main vault. 8 heavily armed federal marshals run down the corridor. They assemble around the vault door. A federal marshal in the monitoring room punches a code into a keypad. It's the combination for the vault door. I'm opening the door. We hear the monitor room's door open. The federal marshals look up and cringe. Both are shot dead in their chairs. Outside of the main vault in the bank, tumblers electronically roll and a motor hums. The vault door begins to slowly open. Around the vault door, the team of federal marshals breathing heavily brace for the firefight. 4 discs scuttle across the tile floor coming from behind them. The federal marshals stare at the discs. They explode, spewing gas. The marshals recoil, then collapse, unconscious. The 2 English businessmen step towards the vault door. They move inside the vault, coming face to face with their comrades, entering from the drilled hole. Then, supremely, comes Simon Gruber. He stands there, blue eyes flashing, staring at 34% of the world's gold currency gleaming on the pallets, stacked to the ceiling. Gentlemen, I present you with a golden opportunity.
I am so glad they chose to shoot it and change it the way they did in the minute that we had.
So am I. It's so much better this way.
It shows. Well, first of all, the way the script's written, we've seen that already. We've seen it in so many other movies. We even saw that technically in the first Die Hard when they kind of throw the little puck down the hall to get the guard.
That's right.
And mm-hmm. I like seeing this as more military precision. Once again, you kill if necessary, but you don't waste your ammo. You don't make no extraneous moves, no extraneous shots, no extraneous yelling and movement. Very efficient. And I like it all feels like, you said it earlier, not only militaristic, but it feels like a well-trained group of people that are used to working in these kind of operations.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top 5 movie trilogies. I keep it a little bit, I'm a little flexible here when it comes to trilogies. So however you want to do it, that's fine by me.
All right. Well, you've made it very, very hard, because obviously we can't ignore the Die Hard trilogy. I mean, you're in the middle of doing the third movie.
You can.
Well, you could, but that doesn't make any sense. So I actually have an honorable mention, but I almost, and I will tell you at the end, that I was going to make a trilogy of a film series that actually has six movies. Well, technically seven, but, and then I was like, well, that's technically not a trilogy. So
Harry Potter is not a trilogy.
No, I was not going to pick Harry Potter. All right, let's go. My number five, and this was actually harder than I thought ranking them, but my number five is the Indiana Jones trilogy. But you're like, wait a minute, there's five movies. No, the fourth movie doesn't count.
No, there isn't.
The movie was terrible. So fifth movie was better than the fourth, but those two are so removed in my mind from the original that I just look at the first three movies. So Indiana Jones. Number four, ironically, is the series we're going through right now, Die Hard.
But there's only three of them. Just kidding.
I know there's more, but I'm using the Die Hard 1, 2, and 3.
I know.
My number three, and because it was a true trilogy, is why I put it above Die Hard. I was trying to figure out whether I wanted Die Hard as three or four, but I was like, well, you can make the argument that you're only picking the first three movies. And an actual trilogy, and I am glad that they've never added a fourth, Back to the Future.
I thought that's where you were going.
Now, I'm going to say that even though I use the excuse of Back to the Future was a true trilogy, so you would think that two and three or one and two are also. But for me, it is the original trilogy. It took forever for them to do prequels, which to me are separate because that was like its own trilogy. And then there were the following sequels were kind of like their own trilogy. So in my mind, the Star Wars episodes 4, 5, 6, that's my second favorite trilogy.
Okay. And I wonder what your number one is going to be.
Oh, you know what my number one is. And this is technically a cheat as well, because I don't think of it as a trilogy. It's just one movie that was released in three parts, but Lord of the Rings. Without a doubt, not only the greatest trilogy of all time, but the greatest, in my mind, still the greatest film of all time to pull off what they did cinematically and thematically and acting and visual and everything is still my all-time favorite movie.
Yeah, I still remember the agony of having to wait a year between each of those movies.
Me too. My honorable mention, if I could have had an honorable mention, and it's one my wife and I just went back recently and we just rewatched, and I love them if you watch them back to back to back, is the first three Pirates of the Caribbean. That's my honorable mention because I do love everything about those three movies. I love the sword fighting. I love the soundtrack, the score. I love the characterization. I love the double play and the double crossing. And it's so much fun for me. And then the one, and I know you don't like the pirate movies at all. I love the first three. I think it's a great, satisfying, you know, you spend an entire afternoon snowed in or something and you just can't go anywhere. Or if it's yucky outside, watching those three movies back to back to back is just phenomenal. My other one that I was going to bring to you, and I didn't know what your thoughts were. I'm a big fan of the Star Trek movies, but if you look at all of the Star Trek movies from the motion picture, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, you know, 2, 3, and 4 are like a trilogy unto themselves. Because 2 was a completely separate story from the motion picture. Starts off with the Wrath of Khan. And at the very end, we know Spock dies, but we have a moment where something's there. Then we go to Search for Spock and we realize, oh, we're not done with that story. Spock left his Katra into Dr. McCoy. So we continue that story where they end up stealing the Enterprise. They blow it up. They're on the Bird of Prey at the end. That's the only ship they have left is the Klingon ship, which is how they're returning themselves in 4, The Voyage Home. So
yes,
I think of that as a perfect Star Trek trilogy. And I love watching 2, 3, and 4. I do the same thing. I'll watch those all in one sitting if I can, just like one big long movie.
I completely agree with you on that one. And I even have one of my guests a few weeks ago actually included that on their top five trilogies, the Star Trek Genesis trilogy.
Exactly. And so I didn't pick it because I know it technically isn't. It's in the middle. You're just picking three movies out, but they do interconnect to me as a trilogy. And those are the three.
Well, it's the same storyline that goes through the three of them. You know, that's what it comes out.
Overall arc through the three. Yep. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, there we go. Those are my trilogies.
Excellent. Okay. So Alan, would you like to once again, tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, I do a daily news talk style podcast. It's a look at the news of the day. Obviously, being in the United States, I'm more focused on U.S. politics rather than world. But if you want to just kind of stay on top of what's going on and get my analysis, you can find The Alan Sanders Show, and Alan is spelled A-L-A-N, but The Alan Sanders Show, on just about every podcatcher out there. And of course, I'm on all the socials as well if you want to follow me. And if you have a question or you just want to, you know, send me some hate mail, you can send it to thealansandersshow@gmail.com.
And I can attest to the fact that it's a very informative show. I do my best to listen all the time also. And I'm not just saying that. No, Alan knows I'm telling the truth because I bug him every day with questions.
I get detailed reviews and questions, and I love it. No, I love that, and I appreciate it, man.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter. You can now find me on Instagram. You can send me an email to moveyourobminute@moveyourob.net. And if you want to go to my website, it's moveyourobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay. When
he comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.